California Chinese American Oral History Project, jointly sponsored by the UCLA Asian American Studies Center and the Chinese Historical Society of Southern California, February 14, 1981, second interview with Marshall Ho in Hollywood, conducted by Beverly Chen. Okay, Mr. Ho, when anyone in your family got sick while you were growing up, did they prefer Chinese or Western medicine?
It all depends on the economic situation to a great extent at the time. Because when you try to get Western medicine, mm-hmm. either those who have a few Chinese who have succeeded in graduating from Western medicine, or to see an actual, what they call ethnically, an Anglo-type practitioner, it costs considerably more money than a Chinese herbalist or a Chinese practitioner inside of Chinatown. In that case, it's very easy to get an appointment to walk down the street and say, is Master Mass so and so home, you know, and then we look at the pulse taimak, you know,
mm-hmm, right.
It's very easy. Now, on the other hand, because the minority has always felt itself in some ways not only different, but and a feeling of inferiority was imposed upon us. And so we felt that they are more magical than we were, because therefore they have the hospitals and everything. And on top of that, when you're sick, you have to have a doctor's certificate before you can resume school if you're out
right,
more
right.
than a week.
Uh-huh.
So you're forced more or less to, if you have a severe illness or that prolonged illness, you do try to see a Western practitioner or at least a Chinese doctor who practices Western medicine.
Uh-huh.
On the whole, it's a combination of both. Whatever you have on hand, or you can afford, you have headache pills, or you have headache pills. That's Western medicine. Or if you need herbs, then you have the Chinese. So it's hard to define very clearly. I say it is a mixture, just like the culture itself at that time in Chinatown.
Did you ever take a long time?
Yes, we do have what they call semi medical ingredients, which call healthcare ingredients. Like, for instance, it's because it's an old culture, we have developed a sense of what they call folk medicine.
Uh-huh.
Because certain things are, when you're too toxic, what Chinese call it hay,
oh.
and then you take something that will cool the system off or make it alkalinize the system when it's too highly acid. Or you're too cold or you're too horn,
mm-hmm.
then you have something to take away. That coldness in the body by something using ginger and you know, other things, you know. So these are, of course, semi-medicine, but it's called home remedies, like New England folk medicine.
Could you give me a few examples of the
Take, for instance,
things?
With our people who raised us, generally speaking, it has every 4 or 5 days or once a week have Qing Bo Liang, which is a kind
mm-hmm.
of a to clarify or to harmonize or to, what I say, alkalize the acid condition of our body. And when we have coughs, other things, we yunfai. We would have probably using certain types of dates cooked so that theoretically our lungs will be eased by certain ingredients that can be found in these food objects, you know.
I see. And but for major illnesses, you would
major still. Illnesses, we depends. Sometimes it's convenient to get a Chinese herbalist.
Oh.
Yes, because herbalists in those days cost about $1, you know, a package of herbs that you cook
$1?
At home.
$1? That's
yeah.
a lot, isn't it?
Well, you know, that's $1 you pay him. Yeah,
but it includes, in other words,
includes your courtesy and everything else, you know, the call, you know.
Right. Whereas the Western doctor, how
Western
much
would you call you? You cost you $3, $4, $5, $5, and then you top that, he can't see you right away. You get your appointment next Thursday. By that time, you're either dead or you recover. In either case, you don't need him.
I see. What kinds of jobs then were Chinese engaged in?
Well, the Chinese
before the war.
Before the war,
mm-hmm.
well. Everything has a circle of effects. Let us say, because the parents were not well off, therefore they could not send the children to higher learning centers. because they do not go to higher learning centers, they could not develop a professional skill to have a higher income, mm-hmm. except for those people who are merchants who are, develop a certain amount of perception in business or the proficiency in business. So therefore, the few of the affluent Chinese made their money from business mm-hmm. or from farming. They work very hard and so on and so forth. Once they get around the alien landlord concept, mm-hmm. they're able to have, and also through the thrift, they're able to accumulate some money ahead, you see.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Then the Chinese average citizen have subordinate positions in China, in white society, like house cleaning,
mm-hmm.
like working in kitchens. If they have their own restaurant, then that's one thing. But they can either work for Chinese or they work for whites in the kitchen in a subordinate position.
Do many Chinese work in white restaurants?
Well, they work dishwashers the same way today, like the Mexicans, the blacks work the dishwasher, or young people working dishwasher.
They didn't cook or anything like that.
Well, it all depends on circumstances. They occasionally they are cooked when they learn from they're given assistant jobs as cooks. They're not chefs in because many of them are not literate. So unless the restaurant itself is not a very big or what they call continental restaurant,
mm-hmm.
the ingredients and the way to prepare them are not too well known to the Chinese. And he doesn't have the literacy to learn very easy. You're talking about a time when not many people have gone very up the scale of the educational ladder.
What about the people who were born here? Like yourself, who have gone to school, who can speak English very well, they must have been more socially mobile than the newly arrived Chinese.
It's very true. But you're talking about before the war. There is a what's called a decade or epochal space. Let us say 20, 30, 40, 50,
mm-hmm.
50. 40, let's say, anyway, that each 10 years bring a little bit improvement in the livelihood or
mm-hmm.
class position of the Chinese American, because each time his education is a little wider or higher and he more jobs are available to him. But he's always in a situation where he works for a little less, possibly, or he takes a little bit more rougher circumstances than his white counterpart.
Mm-hmm.
This changed, however, after the war, during the war and after the war, when Chinese are discovered to be very good workers, conscientious workers,
mm-hmm.
and meticulous workers, and the patient workers,
mm-hmm.
I also don't know whether it's a good attribute or not, because to realize that one's position is inferior and force you to be much more put out more than the average person or the whole your job. I don't know whether that's because of the pride in workmanship or because the social circumstances make you put out more, you see. There is a point of view there which is debatable, that whether fellow workers call you a good worker or whether the boss call you a good worker.
I see. So most Chinese then were still
menial,
as of before, menial
or
jobs.
Or low
before,
professional jobs,
the world.
Like dental assistant. Maybe they can train you,
were there dental assistants?
A few.
Before the world?
Yeah, because they were beginning to be slowly trained. That's around 1930, coming to the 40s, because it's not considered a top job yet, but the Chinese use their own people to be assistant, and it's a higher stage than the, just say, working in a restaurant, or working in a laundry, or working in the farm, or working in somebody's home.
So yeah, were there many people in the dental medical professional fields before the war?
Not many. They are beginning to. And after the war is over, because of the serving in the services allow them to be exposed to many technical departments. They become more. But whenever they become technically good in, let us say, mechanical line, like become a mechanic or electrician, they tend to set up their own little business within Chinatown, like mechanic. They open a little garage there, you see.
Do you suppose they would set up a mechanical repair shop in Chinatown versus Hollywood or
because some at that other at place. At the time, the image of the Chinese had not attained what they call total social acceptability. Now there's a tendency to accept maybe all Asian mechanics and other people more, and even sometimes superior circumstances to whites, because a number of factors, hard to say, the eminence of Toyota, Datsun, and let's say Nikon and Canyon has indicated possibly Orientals are not only have equal grasp of the mechanistic faculties, but also maybe superior in that they're much more conscientious in the work. I don't say this is necessarily true, but it does seem that way.
Yeah,
overall.
Right now that's the case. It wasn't because they couldn't speak English back in those days.
See, in those kind line of work, it doesn't require too much literacy.
I see.
Isn't it? You know, you can fix the car, you fix the car.
I see. So it was discrimination then, in another sense.
Yeah, the discrimination is gradually, you know, lightened as the brides came home from Japan, let us say.
Mainly because of numbers.
Yeah, there's a lot of Mexican.
There's
so many Japanese brides coming back. There's tens of thousands coming back to Americans. Plus the fact that America was allies of China. China was allies of America. So therefore, there are many Chinese soldiers stationed in Chinese ports or work together with Chinese soldiers. So there. The gradual intermingling becomes a factor in acceptance. There is still discrimination, even today. You don't see many Chinese mayors around, do you?
No. What would have been considered an average income in the pre-war period?
Oh, well, let's say that the average income would be pretty good. You get $100 a month.
Mm-hmm. And how much would rent be?
Rent would be something like between $25 and $50.
Uh-huh. And a loaf of bread, say?
Loaf of bread. I bought bread in the Depression as low as 10 cents, but then I was the average 25 cents.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, you must remember when you say before the war, that's a long span between the Depression. I was a child of
the Depression.
Post-Depression, yeah. Mm-hmm. I bought the bread as low as 2 cents during the Depression.
Oh.
Day-old bread,
huh?
2 cents, I think.
And did many Chinese send money back to China? I know
you
did. You were requested to do so. You didn't say whether you did or not.
I did occasionally when I can afford it. Some of my kin in Canton claims much kinship of which I have no absolutely certainty about. But there's a note of authenticity. They say, oh, we know your grandfather, and we are same villages, and we are kin, and we are in have hard times, so you can spare something like, you know, we'll use it to work on your farm, which you may have some legal
claim to
a portion. So I did send when I'm a little ahead, you know.
Uh-huh.
And it's kind of a ritualistic thing that do what other Chinese do. Most of the older Chinese do, and many of the younger Chinese who recently came from China do send money back to China. Because that was the purpose of coming to this, you know, Golden Hills, to make your fortune and go back.
The relatives that sent you these letters. You've never met them.
No.
But you send them money anyway.
Send them money. They send, once in a while they send a picture, but you know.
I see.
And I had to have the letters translated too at that time.
Oh, that's right.
I'm going to meet part of it.
Did other Chinese do the same thing?
Chinese who
send
are older
back?
Done a great deal. As I indicated, those who come from China, you must remember, my grandfather came here in the latter day of the gold rush. So therefore, my feeling for the Chinese customs are not that sharp, see?
Mm-hmm.
However, living in Chinatown, a lot of Chinese are here about what is the custom thing to do. So you do the thing that you think is right, you know. For that matter, I send money to other places too, you know, when people ask me to, like they have starving Africans or something like that. I give money, but not in the amount that I send to relations.
No, I'm talking about your other Chinese American friends. Did they do it?
Depending how close they are to the old custom. Many Chinese Americans begin to move out of China, they become Americanized, and they have nothing to do with China.
I mean, back in before the war.
Yeah, even then, there are people that are emerging out of the Chinese Chinatown. Oh yeah, it's not that close, and it gradually getting out of Chinatown, even in the late 30s.
Did you know of any personally?
Oh yeah, I know many Chinese who begin to live outside of Chinatown, you know,
because they were successful or upwardly social.
Because they're making a little bit more money, and we had nothing to tie them down to Chinatown, and because it may cost more to live in Chinatown than live outside.
Oh really?
Why not?
Is that why they move outside?
Chinatown is small, there's more Chinese from all over, and the limits are defined. So, and the Chinese Chinese slumlords profit on each other. So why not go to a place where other people live, black and Mexican, live much cheaper?
You meant that the people who moved out were those who were able to sort of pull themselves up out of the ghetto.
Well, to a certain extent, this is true on both ends of the ladder. You know, it obviously is cheaper to live in Mexican district than to live in Chinatown.
Oh,
right. Today, the highest price real estate in the world right now is in Chinatown.
Yes,
so therefore, it's nothing overnight. It's always a gradual thing.
Before the war, it was true too.
Yeah, it's cheaper to live, let us say, in East Los Angeles than live in Chinatown. Although in Chinatown, you can live substandard because you can eat easier in Maesong, you know, and you can live among relatives. But you go further on Indiana and 4th Street, you know, you can stand being away from, you know, Chinese. And
Did many Chinese move into Mexican and black districts, or did they tend to move into white areas?
Well, there are reasons for that. They may open a grocery store in a black area.
Oh, they would.
Or they have a laundry there. Or else they may have a little bit inexpensive restaurant in Mexican area. This is true in all Mexico. There used to be Chinese restaurants all over Mexico.
You see cheaper
restaurants. They call comidas corrientes in Mexico. Mm-hmm. You see, and you see them Chinese owned. Matter of fact, the last time I was in Mazatlan,
did many Chinese actually operate businesses in black areas?
Not a great deal, but there's enough.
In other words, there was no discrimination or disdain toward the blacks.
Oh, toward the Chinese.
But on behalf, from the Chinese.
There is, we're generalizing, but I would say we feel differences, but differences not necessary of disdain or contempt, mm-hmm. either way, you know. There is what they call a stereotype characteristics, though. These people are rougher, or these people are more coyote, you know.
More what?
Coyote, you know. Coyote is a Mexican term for, you know, people who are slick, you know, who are cunning. So therefore, there is a feeling that some Chinese are considered coyote.
Oh.
On the other hand, it's not total.
Chinese
Chinese themselves, you know. You know, they better have any other customer than other Chinese, because Chinese are very, very cunning, you know, or very slick in business, or very hard customers.
I thought that's what they say about the Jewish people.
Well, the Chinese say that about Chinese. You hear all my colleagues say, I don't want no Chinese customers. You know, it's acupuncture, you know. They have trouble, you see.
Collecting payments? Or?
No, not that. If you're okay, they expect you to be okay. You got a little thing. You know, along with you, they complain. If you're successful, they're envious.
Oh, I see.
They knock you down, see? It's the kind of thing that's...
Would you consider Chinese to have done better or worse than the general population of L.A., economically?
Economically, they've done better than, let's say, the whites.
I think so, huh?
And on the whole, because basically, when you take college entrance, people in percentage in relationship to the Chinese each decade higher, the Chinese have gone way higher in percentage-wise than the general average American population.
Yeah. While we were talking about the Jews, have you heard of people comparing Chinese with the Jewish people in ways of doing business?
They use it as a stereotype again. I grew up with many poor Jewish people.
You did? I thought you said you grew up in San Francisco, Chinatown.
Chinatown,
Oakland,
but I'm talking when I say growing up. I'm not talking only just when I'm an infant. You know, I'm talking about my life as a human being up to maturity. In the latter days, you know, when I'm in my early 20s, before I attained full, I lived a while in Boyle Heights there. You know,
That was Jewish, that's right.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And those are poor Jews, Jews without money, who came as a refugee from Russia, Poland, from the pogrom, and they're very human, you understand? We have a tendency to stir it up. On the other hand, because the Jews, they are deprived in Europe of the capacity to get land. Mm-hmm. They're forced to go into trade, and many generations being in business sharpens your ability, you know? So therefore, they understand the nature and the techniques of business better than other people, and in time develop what they call an urban mentality, how to deal in trade successfully. Well, Chinese have the same thing in Southeast Asia. The Cantonese in Thailand, in you know, in Vietnam, and as a matter of fact, they say the Chinese, they accept it because of the same race, you know, the same race as the Jews are accepted here racially, but whether it's called culturally or religiously, they discriminate against. Mm-hmm. And vice versa, because the Jews say, oh, he's a Goya, you know what I mean? He's outside the Jew, yeah. He's outside the Jews. There's only two kinds of people in the world, Jews and non-Jews. The Chinese say the same damn thing. He's a Chinaman, he's not Chinese, or he's not a Chinese. You understand, you know? The humans are similar, see?
Yeah.
Given the circumstances.
Now, do you feel that there's a closer, say, cultural affinity between, or the not affinity, that the Jewish people and the Chinese people have more in common?
Yeah, well, in one respect.
Other groups.
In one respect, the Chinese look at the Jews, he doesn't know they're Jewish or not, because the so-called racial stock and in appearance and skin color, they're the same, except they have a certain Mediterranean look, you know, darker.
Yeah.
On the other hand, the reverse is has to make a comment this way. Because of the minority status of the Jews in the world, they've been persecuted, they have developed a sense of humanity. That is a moral consideration. That is to say, some of the greatest philosophers and musicians and artists and so forth has a very strong moral human, you know. You see? Take for instance the Bible, the prophets are Jewish. Jesus is Jewish. You see, and even the Islam came from Jewish influence, even though today they may be in combat. But because that moral consideration arises, not necessarily from innate born birth, but because if you are a minority, you know, and you are persecuted, the thing to do is to appeal to the world on a moral basis. You can't appeal to the world on a military basis. When you're weak, you must be moral.
Yeah.
I don't say that necessarily as a detriment to the Jewish. I'm going to say that you cultivate morality to survive in a world of force, of what we call unreasonableness. Because like fascism and Nazism, it's a denial of morality. So therefore, in that sense, the Jews are more closer to the Chinese in understanding, in attempt to understand, because they are not like, let us say, the traditional American redneck.
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't understand how these chinks can understand each other. You know, this mentality, you understand?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Changing the subject now, where did most Chinese men meet their wives?
The third generation, they meet them here.
The third generation.
Yeah, the sons.
Will you be considered a second generation?
The third. My grandfather came here and later had to go rush. My father was the second generation. I'm the third generation.
Your father's wife, meaning your mother, was she born here?
She was born here, yeah.
I see. And your father was
born here in San Francisco, yeah.
Oh, right. I see. So most Chinese people married other Chinese, whether they were born here or not, I guess.
Yeah, they tend to, because you eat the same thing and you face the same discrimination. And, racially, you're more in tune because you're more gentle. I have to say that Chinese are more gentle. Cantonese talk rough, but they know by nature they're more gentle. You know, gentle.
Really?
Oh, Cantonese are really, you know, something else.
Right.
Loud talking, profane. But then you have to realize that the amount of people who came here originally were, you know, who were rougher class, who could not find employment in China. It's not a derogatory remark. It's a class analysis.
Yeah, but did many Chinese go back to China to get married?
Yes, some people
among your friends. You know,
some, not a lot. When you say a lot, it's not true. the tendency that it's cheaper here to beat somebody and get married.
Oh,
and then you go to China, you have to pay money and take a middle person, you know, and, mm-hmm. and then you have to go across over the water, and you have to leave your job, you know.
But they do that.
Some families who marry somebody who came for who's, you know, interlock the land or, you know,
for social purposes or economic.
More than that, you know, it's not Chinese are too subtle to say anything for any reason, you know.
No, but
they always use escapes as saying that they're, you know, same culture, you know, we are furthering, you know, offsprings that, that yeah. you know, the Chinese look. Are less forthright than Westerners, if you want to generalize. They always have an excuse for something, you know. They use that excuse to say what they want to do.
What was the attitude of Chinese Americans toward having children? Did they prefer male children or female children or people
it's a
of
tendency,
your background?
Yeah. Now the Chinese Americans don't care, but in the old days, because of the cultural momentum, they like to have sons. Because a son can work in the father's business and stay the same name. Otherwise, a daughter marries somebody else, become different name.
I see.
Assets, you know.
Do many parents feel it was important for their children to go to Chinese schools? Meaning in America? Here,
if you live close by the Chinese
the
school, yes, it's good. Because China, in the period before the World War, mm-hmm. and during the period of the downfall of the Qing Dynasty and then the early days of the Republic was very nationalistic. Mm-hmm. And the nationalism was not fostered by the Chinese themselves so much, you know, the hinterland Chinese, although they became that way too, but it was fostered by the educated class. The returned students, the intellectuals in China, and the overseas Chinese. Mm-hmm. So therefore, the overseas Chinese is infected in some ways by Chinese nationalism
mm-hmm.
in China. And it says, Gao Guok.
Mm-hmm,
you know, and then afraid of being Hmong, that is to say, being submerged, you
right.
know,
mm-hmm.
oppressed. So therefore, they say we are culture, and they're facing discrimination. They mm-hmm. felt that we will never be thoroughly accepted in America, so we want to retain a cultural continuity.
And what was your attitude toward this? You said you had gone to Chinese schools. So
I had gone to Chinese school for a brief time, you know, but most of the time I was self-educated to a certain extent. You know,
I went to English or
in Chinese.
In
English, I have to go to school.
Uh-huh.
You know, true and honest will get you.
Yeah.
But in Chinese, I studied by comparing Chinese newspaper with the English edition, and I was interested in events in China.
Mm-hmm.
I'm one of those people who, for some unknown reason, tends to be very morose by myself, I guess because I was an orphan or something, but I there are periods of my life when I lock myself up and read a lot, you know, study a lot,
mm-hmm.
and I become introspective.
Are you able to read Chinese, or were you
able to read Chinese up to a junior high level, let us say, maybe just beginning junior high level.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, I can read Ba Waman, you know, to a certain extent,
mm-hmm.
and a little bit of Manjiang, but not much.
And can you converse in
I can converse in
Chinese.
Cantonese.
Say yep, right.
Sanghua and say yep. I can converse in two dialects. I can converse in Huiping. It's Li Yipwa.
Yeah,
And then I can say Sanghua. You see, that's two dialects.
You know. You learned that from your uncles?
I learned that from Chinatown.
Oh, just from hanging around China.
Yeah, and also we listen to them.
With your relatives, though, I assume you converse mostly in the, say, the Huiping.
No,
right?
I converse in California Chinese. California Chinese is a little bit different from Shangxianhua, tinged with some English words, you know.
I thought since you were brought up by your uncles.
Well, you mix
aunt,
it up, just like the Mexicans, too, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Why did you bring back the car? You know?
Did many people hope to go back to China in those old days when you were growing up?
Well, when I was growing up, there was that hope to go back, but that is almost like a ritual to go up when you talk about golden days. That means that when I was young in my early years, you know, teenage years mm-hmm. or early days. But as time goes on, the higher standard of living here and the more opportunities open, and the fact that when some of them go back to China, it's very poor and there's not no opportunity, there come two kinds of people. Those who want to finished ability as engineers and stuff, hoping to get a big job in China to become part of the thing. But when they saw the corruption in China and there's no employment, excepting you're part of the, you know, the bureaucracy, then they get discouraged and come back here. In the meantime, the opportunities are wider and wider here.
When you say corruption, you mean what period of time in
China? I'm talking about the 1920s and 30s. How who you get a job with in China? Because everybody has nepotism.
Nepotism.
Hire your own family or get your own, clan in. Mm-hmm. What does he know? Then you say, what that got to do with it?
What did the American-born Chinese think of schools in China and going back there to study?
Many do, because the father and mother says you have to go back there in order to learn Chinese. Don't lose your thread, as right. if that's a very big, important thing. There are certain things become cliché.
You don't feel that it's important?
Well, now I realize for what it is, and it's important. But in those days, there are some set rules, you know. Don't cannibalize your mother, and don't, you know that thing. Something horrible happened to you if you don't follow this cliché. You understand that? You don't really understand why, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But you develop a feeling that everybody goes to China to, you know, you can make enough of, after you come out of high school, go to Lingnan or Beijing or something like that.
Did you want to go to Lingnan or Beijing?
No, I never had the hope because my family is too poor. I graduated from school into a janitorship.